One of the books I'm reading right now is by Presbyterian executive Jill Hudson, a book titled, When Better Isn't Enough, Evaluation Tools for the 21st Century Church. The purpose of the book is, first of all, to lay out some of the ways in which the church today is no longer the same church as the church of yesterday. She frames it in terms of modern and postmodern times. Then step two in the book is to offer tools for evaluating pastors and congregations in this new age. She contends that evaluation data needs to be both technical and value-based. That is, not just measured in terms of a bottom-line list of accomplishments, but also in terms of the spirit and intention of things. She talks about the terms leadership and transformation, and how those need to be accounted for, even as they are difficult to pin down. And evaluation, she says, should be not just summative, but formative. In other words, evaluation can and should be a means of learning that then produces positive change and new energy for the work. Anyway, I'm looking at this book to see if there might be something there that would be helpful for us to use. And in an early chapter, the author mentions that even in these times of general church decline, there are some congregations that are thriving. And then she offers a list of qualities that thriving churches share. The list includes things like the community is welcoming and accessible to everyone, worship is innovative, thoughtful, alive, and relevant, a significant bond exists between members so that true community exists, teaching and preaching are scripture-based, the church reaches out to people and needs in the immediate area and beyond, leadership is conscious of the diversity of members and leadership is able to adapt, ministry emphasizes deep relationship with God and true spirituality, decisions are made collaboratively involving broad lay leadership. And there are a few more on the list besides. But at the top of the list was this quality. A joyful spirit is evident. And I have to confess that that one caught me by surprise. I mean, it shouldn't have, because of course, if there isn't a joyful spirit, then really what's the point? But it caught me by surprise. In growing and thriving congregations, a joyful spirit is evident. And so I had to think, why is it that if I had been making the list of what I think of as necessary for thriving and growing congregations, I would have come up with nearly everything else on the list in the book I was reading. Welcome, relevance, adaptability, relationship, true spirituality, diversity, thoughtfulness, collaboration, but I wouldn't have thought immediately about joy. After preaching about hope last Sunday, I admitted to someone who was shaking my hand at the back of the sanctuary after worship that I'm not particularly optimistic. I can be hopeful, but I'm not really optimistic by nature. The person kind of frowned at me. I think they'd like me to be more positive. And so I worry about whether I might get a similar reaction if I were to confess that I'm not, by nature, particularly joyful. I wonder whether that too might be a disappointment to some people were I to confess that. I think the key to self-awareness in that statement, I worry about whether I might get a similar reaction if I were to confess that I'm not by nature particularly joyful, is not found in the word joyful, but in the word worry. It's easy to assume that the opposite of joy is sorrow. And maybe it is at times. But I wonder whether just as likely is the possibility that the opposite of joy is worry or anxiety. Because it would be my observation that nothing kills joy like worry. This is the way it works. Joy needs confidence to flourish. Joy needs to know that there is a basis for trust, that there is room for joy, for there to be room for joy. Doors and windows need to be wide open. The space can't be closed off, secured against all intrusions. Joy needs open space, trusting space, confidence space. On the other hand, when I worry, it's mostly about wanting to control things so they will turn out in a certain way. It's about not trusting my surroundings, not trusting the powers that be around me. Will those who have power get the upper hand? Will I be safe? Will harm come to me and those I love? Worry encourages a siege mentality in my psyche. Joy, on the other hand, pays little attention to the walls that worry wants me to build and maintain. Joy is more interested in the possibility and the beauty and the release of being completely of and in the moment. Joy wants to sing. Worry is always cocking its head and listening for danger. The prophet says, "The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall blossom and rejoice. Like the crocus, it shall rejoice and blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing." The context for Isaiah's prophecy is the return of the people from exile. They have had a hard time, the hardest of times. But finally, they are going home. And God is promising to take them on a path that will not only lead them through the desert, but that will change the desert through which they are traveling. So they will delight in not only their destination, but they will delight in what they see along the way. Think about that. Isn't it true that to be in a state, in a spirit of joy, we have to not only delight in our destination, but delight in what we are seeing along the way? Delight in the now, not continually worrying about what's to come, but to be glad for the now. Because now a new thing is happening. Now people are changing around us. Now the desert is coming alive. Now life is singing. "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy." There, again, in these prophetic words is that connection between joy and a revival of all the senses. Joy is an emotional thing, but it is also a physical thing. It is leaping and singing. What makes room for joy in you? What makes room for joy? I was trying to think about the last time I leapt for joy, and it didn't take me long to come up with it. It was that moment about 2 months ago when the boys' high school soccer team I helped coach won the first ever sectional championship game on Sam Reichenbach's penalty kick in the post-overtime shootout. In the moment when that happened, I literally jumped for joy. And I ran out onto the field. Where was I going? What would I do when I got there? None of those thoughts entered my head. I was completely in the moment. There was no calculation and therefore no hesitation. I just rushed onto the field toward the gathering crowd of celebrating players and fans. My joy overtook my caution. I did not think about anything but my pure delight in what had just taken place. I reached the teeming swarm of people celebrating, and do you know what happened? I got knocked to the ground, straight to the ground, and I couldn't get up. It's like that, I've fallen and I can't get up. It wasn't a safe moment as more people piled onto the growing group there on the ground. I should have been afraid, but strangely, I felt no panic. I just reached up my hand and I said to the faces of those closest to me, "Help me up. I can't get up. Help me up." And they did. A half a dozen hands just picked me up off the ground. I've thought about that moment and that feeling a number of times since it happened. I don't think it was just the winning that made me so overjoyed. I think it was the instantaneous recognition that the boys who did it, who I care so much about, were participating in an event, in a moment that they will never forget. It was the delight of seeing so much work and so much patience and even some adversity overcome by things finally falling all in the right direction at the right time. It was sharing an experience of accomplishment with a close group. It was trading in the perpetual question of when for the answer now. Here's the thing about joy as well. Once you have walked into its embrace, you can always return to that feeling in all its depth and delight. Joy is best experienced when we release ourselves to now, but joy also sharpens our memories, providing a place to which we can return. And here's another thing to which I have already alluded. Joy has something to say, something to do with safety. Listen to Isaiah again. A highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it, but it shall be for God's people. No traveler, not even fools, shall go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there. But the redeemed shall walk there, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. I was a little hard on Frederick Buechner last week when I talked about his association of hope with wishful thinking in his book of Christian vocabulary titled Wishful Thinking, A Seeker's ABC. But he does have another little companion book to that one titled Whistling in the Dark, A Doubter's Dictionary. And the thought of singing as a testimony that our anxiety has given way to joy, that we might, quote, return with singing, sent me to the introduction of that second book. There, Buechner writes, I think of faith as a kind of whistling in the dark, because in much the same way, it helps to give us courage and to hold the shadows at bay. To whistle in the dark isn't to pretend that the dark doesn't sometimes scare the living daylights out of us. Instead, I think it's to demonstrate, if only to ourselves, that not even the dark can quite overcome our trust in the ultimate triumph of the living light. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Are you seeing the connections? Joy in the now rather than worry about the future. Singing that both gives us courage and expresses our courage. The movement from exile to home. Deserts that bloom along the way. Bloom even though we wouldn't have expected it to be so. Anxiety that fades as light comes over the horizon. Like the hope that I talked about last week, joy is not something we manufacture. We don't work harder at being joyful. Like peace, like hope, joy is a gift. God gives it, and we receive it. And then our eyes open, our ears hear, the lame leap, the speechless sing. The promised path, the way to return home from an exile in anxiety. Maybe a step on the path to joy, at least, is learning to trust. Not naively, not in a way that minimizes the very real dangers that we face, but trusting that God is present and that God is at work. And that, as I said last week, grace and goodness is in God's will, and it is God's way, and it keeps going and going and going. So, I'd invite you to be on the lookout for joy this week. Let the delight that you witness become your delight as well. keep a particular eye out for children at play, for persons who are singing, for experiences of teamwork, for moments of discovery or healing. See if you can worry a little less and control a little less while you trust a little more, whistle a little more, especially in the dark places, and give yourself to the now. You may not have that championship moment this week. Those moments rarely come along. But you may find that even if you are knocked to the ground, you don't need to be afraid. That there are people reaching down to lift you up. That God is reaching down to lift you up and to put you on the path that leads you home. Through the desert, past the danger, on a highway called the Holy Way. The youth choir is going to sing in a few moments after the sermon and after some moments of silence. Here's a preview of a few of my favorite lines from the song they will sing. Joy to the people who travel the way. Joy to the ransomed of God. Fears and our need will no longer hold sway. Blind eyes will see, tongues be released, deaf ears will hear new music of peace as we travel the way of the redeemed. I pray it will be so. Amen.